details of how and why. Thank you.
Thank you, John. The next speaker is Dr. Alan Adler of Western Connecticut College in Danbury, Connecticut.
Thank you. Do people hear me without the microphone? Is there anybody back here?
You went to the house lights?
Can you hear me now? All right. The first thing I ought to tell you is how I got into this. I was minding my business, my office, one day. I was not a part of the original team. When this character called and said, "I'd like a little help identifying blood on a piece of cloth." Now, the last time I agreed to do that with him, I found I was involved in a murder case. So I took a little time before I answered. And he said, "It won't take us long. It should be real easy. You're a court for an expert. You can do this thing quick." So I figured, all right, what is it? He says, "It's the Shroud of Turin." I said, "What's the Shroud of Turin? How's a nice little Jewish boy supposed to know what the Shroud of Turin is?" So I took one afternoon and went down. I figured it'd take an afternoon to do this. It's a technique I've worked out quite a while ago. It's very simple to do. We use it almost every day in a lot of testing on iron porphyrins. And I walked and I said, "Where's the sample?" He says, "It's under there under the microscope." And I see this piece of glass slide that he got from Ray Rogers with seven allegedly blood-stained fibers, one piece of his red-brown material. And I said, "You expect us to test this for blood? You're out of your mind." Well, as he said, we took 6 months to finally work out the controls and things, so in fact we could perform that test and do the other tests we wanted. Then I made a further mistake of letting him convince me to go to a conference in Colorado at the Air Force Academy about two Easters ago. I had to go out there for other reasons with respect to the research I was really supposed to be doing. And he said, "You know, we'll pay for your way. You know, how can you lose?" Well, that's always a good invitation for someone who teaches for a living. They don't pay us any more now than they used to in the past. And I made a mistake of coming into this conference, walking in, and somebody was arguing about how to test for protein. I opened my mouth. And the next thing I knew, two guys in Air Force Blue, one of them was here, Bill Erkeline, sort of picked me up, moved me down to a laboratory. The next thing I know, I spent 4 days testing things. I had the flu. Adam Otterbein kept bringing me hot tea, medicines that he would send over, offering me extreme unction if I passed away. And next thing I knew, I was in the chemical testing business on this. Now, I think that it's important to understand a few things I have not really heard clearly expressed so far that people have asked me about. I think people should understand right from the very outset just exactly what this team is doing. There is no possible way science can tell us who is on that piece of cloth. That is not a scientific question. There is no test for Jesus Christ. A single scientific test could tell us this thing's a forgery. If in the middle of the testing I detected thalocyanin, which was a pigment which was first discovered by Lindstedt in the 1920s, and it was all over the cloth, we'd certainly know there was something phony. We could prove it's a forgery. So the best we can do is to find out what is on there and then attempt to explain how it got on there. But we cannot tell you who is on there. Now, actually, a lot of people are asking us, why haven't we proven this is authentic? Well, the opposite is to prove it's a forgery. We have not been able to do that, but we have been able to completely describe the chemistry and a great deal of the physics, and there still is a problem. I'd like to show you now what we've really been able to do with the chemistry and put together some of the pieces you've seen. Can I have the lights out, please? Can I have the lights out?
All the way out.
Completely. Thank you. Now, this is a typical image you've seen before, the shroud of positive and negative. And the first thing to note, that in the negative, which shows a positive image,
as John pointed out, the blood and the scorches show up, well, they don't always wander around like that, but they show up quite differently from the image. Now, part of this is perceptual, but it should be noted that, in fact, what we think of as image shows up with the opposite color tones and does not behave the way you would think an ordinary photograph should show an image. On the other hand, the blood spots and the scorch marks do show up the way you would expect it if you took an ordinary photograph. And this is immediately suggested that a different process was employed in putting them on the cloth from the image, and in fact, a different sort of chemistry. Maybe not in its exact structure, but certainly in its details. So this is the first evidence that's indicative to us that there are things that have to be explained. What we really want to do is to explain the chemistry of this image, to establish whether or not the blood is blood, to talk about the comparisons of the chemistry we see on the cloth itself, on the body image only parts of the cloth, those parts that are adjacent to water stain areas, the water stain margins you see also show up quite differently, and in respect to the chemistry of the scorches and anything else we can find, plus any particles that we can find on there that are there in sufficient concentrations to be evident to the eye as something that's part of the image that's actually seen by the eye. All right, may I have the next slide, please? The spectroscopy was done in place, but the chemical samples that were taken for analysis were taken by what's known as the sticky tape sampling technique. This shows you the captain of our American chemistry team, Ray Rogers, looking on while Max Fry, one of the other people who was engaged in the investigation, is taking an ordinary scotch tape sample. You notice they're using white glove technique and applying it. How many of you own dogs and cats? You all know just before you go out somewhere in your best dark suit, the cat jumps up, puts white fur all over the cloth. You can pull it off with a piece of tape. And of course, you end up, as John said, with fuzz. Well, he's taking a sample for his analysis with ordinary sticky tape. Next slide, please. Ray and Bob Dinniger used a very special puller and a special tape that was provided for us by 3M. It's Mylar. It's a ethylene terphthalate, which comes out as a linear polymer, which is, I'll show you later, gives us some problems, with a proprietary adhesive on it that we identified by low-angle internal reflection IR spectroscopy as, in fact, a polyethylene polystyrene block and grab polymer. We later found we had some traces of oxidants in it, which produced problems in some of the testing. It was mounted on this special type of mounting tray. John said it then went to the hands of the people involved in the chemistry. An investigator previous to us applied it to cover glasses. We had to work through this. Next slide, please. There were 35 such samples taken, approximately 5 centimeters square each tape sample. We received 22 of these. 6 of them were pure blood areas. About another 3 or 4 were blood associated with water stains. We had several water stain tapes, 3 pure body image tapes, and then a number of tapes of scorches and various control tapes for patches and for non-image areas. Unfortunately, predominantly, most of the slides we obtained were actually blood slides. As it turned out later in the testing, it would have been nice if we'd actually had more of the pure body image area slides. However, we did have some that were pure image, not associated with water stain or blood. And this shows you where their locations were on the shroud and what their designations were. Next slide, please. One of the things that we first noticed when we examined these microscopically was that we saw traces of red fibrils, which are obviously silk, and blue fibrils that at first we couldn't identify, on several of the tapes. And in fact, as John said, when we looked, there was debris of ages of all sorts on there. We found insect parts. He said pieces of wool and things that obviously had fallen from the air, ecclesiastical robes. Larry told you the possibility of people worrying about marble dust. There's a lot of strange stuff on there. Furthermore, John Jackson had pointed out that folding of the shroud over a period of years would have displaced particles from mechanical abrasion from one part of the shroud to another. We found that was true after we finally learned to identify what we're identifying. We could find samples of blood materials all over each of the various tapes. So after examining them microscopically in several ways, under the polarizing microscope, top lit, bottom lit transmission, and also on an interface contrast microscope. We made an arbitrary limit that we would require at least 15 of a particular class of specimen to be found on a particular tape sample before we had designated as typical of the sample. Now, we have no statistical validation of this. This is just simply an operational number we've set, which we found is useful, and the only thing we can say is the type of testing we've done, it seemed to have been warranted. Next slide, please. On this basis, we're able to divide the types of classes of materials we had to identify into something of the order of about, I don't remember how many I've got on the next slide, but about 10 different types of samples. First, we saw a number of very pale yellow fibers. The predominant places they were found, in fact, from our control locations. And when they're looked at under the phase contrast microscope, they appeared very smooth surfaced. Then we found, actually, more yellow fibrils. They're slightly more yellow. They were found in the non-image area of the cloth rather than on the control things like the hollow patches and things. And under the phase contrast microscope, the surface of these fibrils started to look as if it were etched, slightly corroded. Then we looked in the body image ones, non-blood, and the fibrils are quite distinctly yellow. And the surfaces here appear corroded under phase contrast. You look at them as somebody had taken a smooth pipe and etched it with an acid. Then from the scorch areas, we could find very dark fibrils. They appeared anywhere from a light to a dark brown. There are some that were, you saw the other day, were carbonized. We saw carbonized materials, but not carbonized fibrils in our samples. And here the surfaces under phase contrast appear very corroded. And this is actually part of the process of the oxidation of the surface. Then we found there were red-coated fibrils in the blood areas, and here the coating went from very smooth. We had some that looked like a piece of red spaghetti over the top of a solid cord, to fractured, to particulate appearing, and near them there were other sorts of fractured materials. And the colors varied anywhere from a deep red through to an orange, down to a fiery, as you see down here in some of the scorch areas, they're quite dark. Now the important thing is that after we removed these particles from the tape and looked in the polarizing microscope, none of these red-coated materials were birefringent or pleochroic. Birefringent means when you look at it in our cross-polarizers, it should light up because they're optically active. It changes the plane of the polarized light so that it's not occluded, which would be if you normally had a pair of cross-polarizers. Pleochroic means that the color changes as you rotate the polarizer. And I'll show you physically what that looks in some later slides. Now, we also found in blood-adjacent areas that we could find some fibrils that were also coated, except instead of being this red color, they're a golden yellow or honey, it's been described by people, but they're definitely coated. And except for the color, they had the same general appearance as those we found in the blood areas. In the water stain margins, and in the areas where blood were near where it was scorched, we found that there were birefringent red particulate coated fibers. Now these look quite distinctly different from these we found on the blood areas. It varied from a deep red to a dark brown. They were birefringent and pleochroic. And furthermore, in the phase contrast study, we could see that some of these particles were actually inside the medulla of the linen fiber. Linen looks like bamboo. It has joints and there's a hollow space in the middle. And some of these fibrils were seen inside that core between intact joints. Next slide, please. Then we found things that looked like shards, like roof tiles that were broken off from ceramic roof tiles. These are the blood areas. And what they were replica coatings from the coated fibrils that had fractured off. Instead of fracturing off as small parts, they fractured off as tablet-shaped materials. These, again, were birefringent, or not birefringent or pleochroic. And in fact, some of these were quite interesting because near the scorch areas, they were distinctly an olive brown color rather than a red or an orangey color. Then we found these orange globs, which just looked like the fractured material from the more orange blood-coated areas. And had the same properties, not birefringent or pleochroic. And then near the real scorch margins, we could find, instead of orange globs, brown globs, which are similar to previous except they're darker in color. And finally, we found some black particulates near the scorch areas that were irregular and opaque. Now, the first thing we did was take this precious 300-year-old linen John talked about, and we made up a number of controls. And we found out if we didn't treat the linen in any way at all, but then start scorching it, it began to look as if it went under the phase contrast microscope. The surface got more and more corroded, and it had the same properties as going from non-image to image to scorch. When we coated it with protein, it resembled the yellow coated ones. When we coated it with protein and iron oxide, it did not look like any of the materials we looked like. It had quite distinctly different appearance. We did some other types of things. There was a suggestion that perhaps the linen had at some point been treated with saponaria. I also have a wife who puts up with a strange husband, just like John does. On the way to work one morning, I asked her to stop the car right near the tracks at the respirating station, went down the station, picked up some fresh saponaria, threw it in the back of the car, brought it into the lab, amazed all the organic chemists in our department because I started extracting it, and made a saponaria extract that we could treat linen with. And we made up some saponaria treated samples so we could develop some controls to compare with this possibility. Saponaria, the egg-like comb part of it, is a triterpenoid. It's similar to the structure of steroids, a structure similar to cholesterol. You know, everybody tells you you're not supposed to eat, but they don't tell you you make almost as much in your body per day as you do eat. We tried some tests similar to that. One of those, just treatment with acid. We found out the treatment with strong oxidizing acid, like sulfuric acid, immediately turned these saponaria treated materials a bright, dark brown red. So in fact, we developed a very simple test for it we could then apply. There was one other possibility, and that's where this iron was coming from. As you heard from both Larry and John, we had some suspicions the iron was not added to the cloth by man, but in fact by the natural process by which linen is actually, flax is converted into linen. And we discovered in hunting around through these textile books that one of the older ways people used to make khaki, they made what was called a mineral khaki, was to take cellulose materials like cotton and linen, immerse them in iron salt solutions, take that out and soak it in lye, that is a base, precipitate iron hydroxide on the surface of the fireball, and in fact, as you'll see in some of the later ones, within the core. And then under dehydrating conditions, you don't need any oxidation at all. You remove water from ferric hydroxide, you end up with iron oxide. Now this would give us an iron oxide that could be precipitated within these hollow cores. So we tried this, and in fact, this worked. We found it gave us an appearance very similar to the materials we found on the water stain margins. Okay, next slide, please. Now, what do these things look like? This is actually what you see on one of these slides in the microscope. You can imagine the horror of a chemist when somebody tells them this is the stuff you're going to analyze. Now, this is not an ordinary light microscope picture. This is under parallel polarized light, with parallel polarizers. We've got plain polarized light where the light, if you can think, is coming through so it only absorbs in one direction. And the polarizers are set so that if it's in that same direction and nothing in the material will change that direction, it'll come through on color. And you'll notice that the fibrils show up different colors and there's particles all over the place. But you'll also notice that the background is not clear. It's a sort of a pinkish yellow color. And the reason is because the tape itself is optically active. As shown by the next slide, under cross polarizers, instead of getting a black field with only the birefringent material showing, it turns a deeper pink. So we discovered with one technique you would use for studying these things was via polarization analysis study, we would not be able to do this on a tape. We would have to remove the materials. And as John said, what we had to do was to excise material from the tape. I let the surgeon do that, you know, a chance for him to play doctor. He would cut out these pieces. We would then take the tape, tweezer held, hold it over our testing apparatus, our spot plates, wash it off with toluene, and then remove all the stickum that's on there because that would interfere with the testing. And that had to be taken away by holding the specimen down with a glass needle under the microscope and absorbing it with a micropipette or a small piece of pointed filter paper. Then you could begin the testing. And this is a laborious process. It's anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes just to prepare a specimen. Of course, usually what happened, the chemist would be sitting there laboring away while the doctor's loafing and hollering. Finally, you'd get up and say, "Will you shut up?" And of course, when you talk that loud, you blow the specimen away and you start all over again. The way you correct this is to tape the mouth of your surgeon, and then you can proceed with the chemistry. You tell them when to cut, otherwise to shut up. And we did over 1,000 of these tests, including all the controls. So we really did a lot of chemical testing. Next slide, please. Now, this shows you a pair of crossed fibrils as seen by ordinary transmission microscopy. While they're in, embedded in the stickum and underneath the cover glass, and you see you can't see much. The stickum itself and the air pockets in it cover up all the detail and you don't really see anything. However, next slide, please. Under phase contrast, you can see clearly that this has an etched and a corroded surface. Now, I must warn you, under phase contrast, while you can see detail clearly, it distorts colors. So you cannot tell by the color. However, we found by playing a bit, if we look at some of the controls, we can see some color differences. And it became apparent to us that things like this, for example, that you see up here, this sort of a blue color, that's really protein. Iron oxide does not show up that way. It shows up a very deep purple under this type of microscopy. So we're able to actually put the fibrils into a progression on this degree of corrosion we could see from non-image to image to scorch. Next, please. This is to show you the problem that we saw with the birefringent stuff. It turns out here is a fibril under parallel polarizers with red-coated material all over it. Next slide, please. And you notice the reason I want the light out is because the only thing that shows up birefringent here is the cellulose fiber, which is known to be birefringent. You notice the particles do not light up. This is absolute proof that, in fact, these particles are not iron oxide. Iron oxide is birefringent pleochroic. Furthermore, we did other tests in the index refraction. We found these red particles we could find somewhere above 1.5, some below. Below, obviously, is a proteinaceous type material. Above is iron oxide type material. When we do this same kind of trick in the water stain margins, they do light up. There is iron oxide in water stain margins and in scorched blood incineration areas. There is not in the blood image areas or in the image areas. Next slide, please. One of the problems that I first had when I looked at these shard-like materials, that actually is the shape and the form and the right characteristics for what Perutz and Kendrew reported as, in fact, the crystal form from methemoglobin, the oxidized form of hemoglobin. And your blood hemoglobin is normally there in a reduced form. I thought, great, this stuff's really the crystals. And here's one of these black spot things we found, as John said, is really debris from the silver debris from the fire. Next slide, please. Under the polarized light, it's quite clear they're not birefringent. In fact, they were not crystalline material. They are, in fact, just replicate cast material coated on there. Next slide, please. Here's one of these orange blobs, again from the near the blood adjacent areas. And see, it sort of looks as if it might be a piece of fractured blood. Now, one of the things I think I should speak about a bit is what blood is. I'm afraid there are too many people labor under delusion. You can go take a bottle of something labeled blood, and it's one compound, and there's a simple test for what it is. Blood, as you're well aware, is a mixture. It's a mixture of several types of serum proteins. There are formed elements in it, the blood cells. The erythrocytes have actually contained the heme protein. There are white cells. There are platelets. There's all kinds of material in blood. Joe Gambisha showed you yesterday, you just let it sit and starts to actually sediment. The formed element parts tend to agglomerate. Furthermore, clotted blood, the serum separates. There's a process called cinereces from the heme protein portion of the blood. There are lysed cells where some of the hemoglobin will mix with the serum. It's not only a mixture of materials, but in fact, as the blood begins to coagulate by different processes, you'll get physically separated materials, as these materials will differentially separate. That means the color will vary all over the place. Furthermore, the heme protein is a very complex material. It contains a porphyrin ring,
one of the real big secrets in understanding life I want you all to know, but we don't have time to talk about that today. And this porphyr material is very unique. It's a very intensely absorbing compound. Unlike most molecular species, it doesn't have one broad band in its absorption of the visible chromophores. It has four in the visible, an immense peak in the ultraviolet, and if it has a metal containment, it readily will chelate metals. You often see minor peaks in the near infrared. So you actually get a number of spectral indicators. Metals are bound, they will pick up different ligands, go to different oxidation states. Every single one of these will change all seven or eight of these peaks. It's very sensitive. That's if the porphyrin ring is intact. Porphyrin rings, in the process of time, either bacterially or by natural enzymes in your body, or by, in fact, environmental treatment, will break down to form what are called biopigments. This is the stuff that gives your aunt trouble when she goes for a gallbladder problem sometimes. You know, when people have these stained gallstones, it's because they contain biopigments. Biopigments are the natural breakdown products of porphyrin rings, and so they also are highly colored. One of them tends to be green colored, one tends to be an olive green color, and one tends to be an orange color. So these are, again, things that we want to look for and can, in fact, show up in some of these materials. If someone had been beaten, excoriated, and scorched, you'd expect to find some of these blood breakdown products within some of the blood sample. Next slide, please. All right, now this is a repeat of one of Sam's slides. This is a microphotograph of a blood area. I think you should notice the fact that there are several things here that are distinctly different from the image areas. Here you do see cementation, evidence of capillarity, and you'll notice that the color of this image is not uniform. You see dark red particles, you see clumps, you see things that look like intubulated fibrils, you see things that look more orange. Clearly this blood is in fact blood which has gone through some type of physical process where some of the elements have separated. And when you put a tape on this, you should expect to find a variety of things. Fractured things, orangey things, red things, and tubulated things, replica casts, just the sorts of things that, in fact, we do see on the tape. So one of the first things you should note is that, in fact, the macro photographs, in fact, give you evidence of the sort of things that we should have seen and we're identifying with blood on the microscopic ones. Next slide, please. This is one of these shard things we saw. And you can see it really does look like something had been fractured off a cellulose fiber. The fact that it's non-birefringent shows you that it's off the cellulose and it's not crystalline. These were some of the things that we did the microspectrophotometry on over at Yale, John was talking about, and were some of the easiest for us to do some of our initial testing on to, in fact, establish the fact that the presence of blood-like materials were present. Next slide, please. This shows you what some of the red-coated particulate materials were like. And you can see that, in fact, the stuff that's on the fibrils looks like some of the junks and globs that are off on the side. And there is quite a range of color and variation in shape and size from being something that looks mechanically abraded to smooth. Next slide, please. Now, what this is a comparison of the transmission spectrum of a blood material. This is one of the shards. With, in fact, the reflection spectra, which is provided for us by SAM from the whole tape, from the whole shroud. Now, I should point out, when you have a material like a heme porphyrin, which has very high extinction coefficients, these things are intensely absorbent. And in fact, one of the things people don't realize, the color of blood is not due to the iron. In fact, when you put an iron in a porphyrin, you actually lower the overall extinction. The dye itself is a very intensely absorbing material, one of the most intensely absorbing materials, in fact, known to man. With respect to the contrast in the background, different things will happen. Without going into all the physics, it turns out the reflection spectra for porphyrin-like materials should reveal to us their structure best in the red portion of the spectrum, red colors, while the transmission spectra should give us better contrast and better identification of the peak-like features that we can see here in the blue and the ultraviolet. Let me first talk about what we did with the transmission spectra on a microcrystal with microspectrophotometry. There's Mount Heller that he was talking about. And it is here at somewhere about 420, which is the expected soiree peak for an iron porter. This is an absolutely characteristic feature of these materials. No other compound known to man will give you that intense absorption in that region. Furthermore, there's a bump in here, which at first we didn't believe. It turns out that this bump that's seen here and seen up there at 450 are in fact indicative of bile pigments, bilirubins in particular, such as bilirubin, one of the breakdown products of blood. We later had a chemical identification of bilirubin in these samples, and it is showing up, in fact, the blood spectra, both in reflection, in transmission, and it's part of the reason for the confusion you've seen on some of the identified bloods that you've seen, like in Joe Acetta's stuff with the infrared. He pointed out yesterday there's probably some other material there. There is other material there. There are blood breakdown products there. This peak